Thank you, Joe. And thank you, Marty, for inviting me on the math side. Actually, some of my friends initially refused to visit me when I moved up to Washington because I was working for the evil empire, but one of them told me that he looked forward to coming to see me after my employer had been sufficiently diminished by the federal government. So now maybe more mathematicians will come. So the title, Quantum Computation and the Localization of Modular Functors, is probably daunting because of the last word, two words, modular functor. I spent the last hour with Tony Z trying to explain what I thought a modular functor was, and it leaves me a little unnerved. But you know, actually part of the point of the talk is that I don't understand what modular functors are very well myself, and I think they're really genuinely a bit mysterious. So if you don't have the exact idea of what they are when I'm done, you'll be in at least a large company. I should say, when I started talking about this subject, as Joe mentioned, maybe 3 years ago, I began to hit on these themes of TQFTs, topological quantum field theories, and computation. I really had very little idea what I was talking about at all. In fact, I have to thank some of my friends like Ike Chung in the audience and Alexei Kataev, who isn't here, for their efforts at educating me on the physics side. Of course, you can judge for yourself how successful they were. So this is sort of the program for today. The idea is that when you hear talks about quantum computers, usually they start by telling you what a qubit is. And it's some very localized thing. It's like the spin of a nucleus or something like that. And then you're told that you're going to array a lot of these and compute with them by entangling the spins. And what I'm going to be presenting is sort of a different idea of doing quantum computation on not physically localized degrees of freedom like the spin of a nucleus, but topological degrees of freedom, which will be encapsulated in a Hilbert space V. And the second point about this is that this Hilbert space will admit a local Hamiltonian description. That is, within some large conventional system of local spins, it'll be possible to describe a Hamiltonian in a way that should be reasonably congenial to physicists, so that the ground state of this Hamiltonian is the topological object, the modular functor, the thing that I want to do quantum computation on. And then an important issue about this space will be its stability, so I want to discuss whether the Hamiltonian has a mass gap. And I think there's a good physical argument that it does, though not a math proof. So the contents, I thought we have to go through three subjects rather quickly in the hour, so we'll do math and physics and computer science. So let me start with a very old math idea that my topology friends in the audience will enjoy, homology. You start with a space, and what algebraic topology is good at doing is giving you some discrete information about a wobbly, fuzzy object, a space, a distortable object. You can extract from it discrete information. So a simple example is the space X I've chosen is the closed surface of genus 2, and I've taken the first homology, H lower 1, and chosen coefficients Z2, about the simplest coefficient group. And what the first homology tells you about the space is the number of independent 1 cycles, and those 4 dotted circles on the space are basis for this. You might ask, well, what about a circle in the middle that would cut the thing in two? Why isn't that there as a fifth guy? Well, according to the equivalence relations of homology, that one wouldn't count. That would be zero. And the homology consists basically of admissible pictures, in this case circles, modulo an equivalence relation, which is Bordism. If the circle bounds something, it doesn't count. That's why the circle in the middle doesn't count, because it bounds either the left or the right. Now, this idea was well understood 100 years ago. And now, 100 years later, we come to this more puzzling thing, the topological modular functor. And one thing you can say about it is it has a good pedigree. Famous people have troubled themselves over it. That, of course, doesn't explain what it is by itself. But I think the origins are more or less in this order. The Jones polynomial, conformal field theory, loop groups, Witten's famous 89 paper, which got me into the subject, though it took me about 8 years of sitting on the fence, where he quantized Chern-Simons theory to produce three-manifold invariants, generalizing the Jones invariants. And then prominent in what I'll be talking about today is a more topological approach through quantum groups pioneered by the Russians, Rushatikin and Turiyev. So now modular functors are not as flexible as this old idea. X, in my example, was a surface, but homology, you can talk about the homology of any space. It could be a three-manifold or not even a manifold. But modular functors are something very special about surfaces. So you could say, well, that's so special I don't even care. It's not like I can talk about the modular functor of anything. I can just talk about the modular functor of a surface. So you might think, well, it's a lot more trouble for a much smaller payoff. Maybe it's not worth the investment. I wonder if that's in focus. That's better. Now, just as an exercise, since I've used the word so many times, let me give you a definition. I consider this definition unilluminating myself. It has not helped me. But this is the definition, for instance, you'll find in Atiyah's book on physics and knots, it's called. And it's essentially the definition that Witten inaugurated in his 89 paper. So here's what you do to construct a certain famous modular functor of a surface sigma. This pointer. You first pick a Lie group, and the first interesting case, the first non-abelian case, is SU2. And then you have to pick a level, which corresponds to a level in representation theory, so that's an integer k. And let's suppress the complex structure for a second. You go over to the representation variety. That's all the homomorphisms from the fundamental group of sigma into SU2, modulo the equivalence relation of conjugation. Now, it turns out that this representation variety has the structure of a singular symplectic manifold. So it has a form, omega, a symplectic form, omega, and associated with omega is a line bundle, a complex line bundle, whose topological twisting, whose Chern class, is the omega of the symplectic structure. Now, if you go back here and temporarily add a structure, complex structure to the surface, which is faintly cheating because we want a topological invariant, it endows the representation variety with its own complex structure. And once that's done, it's possible to talk about the holomorphic sections of the tensor powers of this line bundle. And when you do that, you have a finite dimensional space. The holomorphic sections of this line bundle become this finite dimensional space, and that vector space is the invariant. Just as in the simpler case, it was a vector space over the coefficients that was the invariant of the surface. Remember, our genus 2 surface had a four-dimensional vector space over Z2 as its invariant. By analogy, this determines a finite dimensional vector space corresponding to the surface. And it turns out that the vector space depends only in the faintest way on the complex structure. If you vary the complex structure, the overall space only changes by a phase, an overall phase, which shouldn't be worrisome from the point of view of physics. So a dramatic difference between these spaces and homology is the dimension grows exponentially with a genus rather than linearly. And that's what makes one think of quantum computing and tensor product bases and things like that. That's the dimension is maybe the first hint that they might be related to quantum computation. Now, from this definition, it's a little bit difficult but possible to localize these spaces. After all, for those of you who know homology, homology is built up from the smallest pieces to the largest pieces. You begin with a chain complex, and the chain complex expresses the space in terms of small pieces, simplices. And you take the algebra generated by these simplices and the boundary map, and you do some commutative algebra, and you get out the homology groups. But on the other hand, the modular functor seem to descend from above, from the whole, the representation of the whole fundamental group, and it's not quite clear what a modular functor of a part of a surface is. So this is a challenge. Can you define modular functor for bits of surfaces and discover gluing rules so that you have something like a Meyer-Vitor sequence in homology, so you can put them together from pieces? And sort of several people, almost all the people on my first slide, figured out some way to do this if the surface is cut into surfaces with boundary, so-called pairs of pants being the far as you can go. This is a quaint little topological term for a three-punctured sphere. You call it a pair of pants for the obvious reasons. There's the waist and there's the cuffs. So here I've taken a genus 3 surface and I've divided it into 4 pairs of pants. And it turns out that in order to get a sensible decomposition theory, you need certain labels. I told you that there was a level K that needed to be in the discussion, and that determines a set of labels. For instance, if I may be off by 2, but I think the labels go from 0 to K in the given theory. And these, in physical terms, you might think of these as particle types, and you might think of the Hilbert space associated to these particle types appearing on the boundary as the possible internal degrees of freedom in an interaction which would fuse a particle of type A and a particle of type B and come out with a particle of type C. So you could think of this space as being kind of a Clebsch-Gordan coefficient. It's sort of telling you, in some sense, the number of, if you think of A, B, and C as representations of some structure, it tells you the number of time, its dimension is the number of times the representation C occurs in A tensor B. And that's a little vague because I haven't told you what structure is being represented, but there are several different ways to instantiate that. But it notably remained quite mysterious how to further localize down to small neighborhoods of points. So what a topologist really wants, and is not satisfied until he gets, is topologists would like a modular functor defined on a subsurface with corners on its boundary so that the entire modular functor could be put together by some gluing rule, gluing along edges and corners. So here the gluing rule is, if you know the functor here and the functor here, you should take, for every fixed value of the label, you should somehow take this space and tensor them together, and then a direct sum over the labels. There's a gluing formula like that. And as of the present moment, there's no complete theory of, it's not worked out what the gluing formula should be to localize to what I would say a point or a neighborhood of a point. Now, in order to explain why it's hard to descend, I want to suggest the following strange table. These modular functors come from the characteristic classes associated to a Lie group, in the simplest case, SU2. And in SU2, there's a Pontryagin form. And it leads to a rather straightforward characteristic class in dimension 4, and progressively more mysterious structures in lower dimensions. So the situation, which is familiar to topologists, is if you have a 4-manifold, you can classify an SU2 bundle over it by a map into the classifying space BSU2. And then if you want to know everything about this map up to homotopy, it's told to you by a single integer, which is the degree of this map around the 4-dimensional cycle in this space. So the invariant of this situation, so this SU2 bundle over the 4-manifold, is simply an integer, very straightforward. Now, if you have a 3-manifold and a bundle over it, there's no topological invariant because it slips off the 4 cycle. That's what this picture is supposed to show. This wiggly line is the image of this 3-dimensional manifold. Y is a 3-manifold. I should have had it Y upper 3. I didn't put it on the chart. But if you, now let me give it 2 interpretations. First, topological, then slightly more analytic, of where this invariant comes in the circle for a 3-manifold. So Y is a 3-manifold, and you map it in, and as I said, the sphere here in the picture represents a 4-cycle, and doesn't catch the 4-cycle. It slips off either to the left or the right. But you can choose a way of having it bound, say to the left here, and then you can go ahead and integrate that 4-dimensional form that before gave you an integer. And now it gives you a real number. But then you realize that you made a choice by making it bound to the left instead of the right. And you see that if you made a different choice, the difference between those choices would be the integral over the 4-cycle, which would be 1. So that says you get a real number modulo the integers. So you get something in the circle. And this is the way it's written. Now, a slightly more analytical description is to say that the universal form, the 4 form, in this space, it's not D of anything in that space because it represents cohomology. But if you pull it back to the total space of the universal bundle, which is contractible, it's certainly D of a 3 form there. And there's no topological obstruction to listing the classifying map over a 3-manifold, and once you lifted the map, you can integrate the Chern-Simons form, the thing whose D gives you the Pontryagin form. And that'll give you the real number. Where do the integers come in? In the choice of lifts. There's an integer's worth of lifts. So that's the same ambiguity which downstairs is seen by bounding to the left or bounding to the right. And the two approaches are identified by Stokes' theorem. So that explains how to descend from dimension 4 to dimension 3. But our job is not finished because we want to descend to dimension 2. Well, in order to understand the invariant in dimension 2, it's actually a little tricky. So the associated to a surface is going to be a vector space. And I already told you what Witten's definition of that vector space was. That was the algebraic geometric construction. But if you found that, I mean, maybe from a physics background that seems very natural, but I found that rather impenetrable, and I wasn't happy until I saw a classical construction of the same vector space. Well, of course, the classical construction doesn't give you the same vector space. It gives you an infinite dimensional vector space, but when you apply symplectic quantization to it, you'll get Witten's space. So I don't know if this slide is really worth going through, but I'm giving you here the mechanism to make an object from the Chern-Simons theory, which you can associate to a surface. And the idea is, remember in the last slide, I talked about lifting the 3-manifold up to here and doing some integration. Well, if the 3-manifold has boundary, the result of the integration will depend on a fixed lift or fixed trivialization of the bundle over the boundary. So you can think in the case of a 3-manifold with boundary that trivializations of the boundary, that's the surface, produce relative Chern-Simons invariants of 3-manifolds. And this, if you take two different trivializations over the boundary, trivialization 1 and trivialization 0, the Chern-Simons invariants that are produced will differ by a formula. They'll obey the difference being equal to the integral of Chern-Simons over this cylinder, which connects the two lifts on the boundary. Now, abstractly, one can ask for all functions, which would go from trivializations, all functions which would go from trivializations over the surface to relative Chern-Simons invariants, which would obey this formal difference. And it turns out that the set of such functions is a circle bundle over the space of connections. And then the space of sections of this circle bundle, this plays the same role, or actually its associated line bundle. This is the thing that Witten was talking about, except in Witten's case, it wasn't the space of all connections, but the space of flat connections, which is the representation variety. So that's the zeros of some moment map, and then dividing out by complex conjugation is dividing further by the action of the gauge group. So that slide represented sort of a mathematical high point, and I plan to retreat from it. But the purpose was not so much to definitively explain what the modular functor is, but just show you approaches to defining it. There's an algebraic geometric approach, which seems to work. There's a naive topological approach, which leads to something infinite dimensional and has to be further massaged. So what Witten's hands, when he had the classical Chern-Simons invariant, y is again the three-manifold defined, he did sort of a path integral. He averaged this over the space of connections to produce the Witten invariant of the three-manifold. And then the descent to dimension 2 is more complicated, and that's where I had the algebraic geometric slide, where he defines the vector space V associated to the surface, what I'm calling the modular functor. Well, all this is physics defined. Okay, now Dietmar will be happy with the next slide. The topologists were somewhat distressed by the path integral definition. And Reshetykin and Turiyev produced a combinatorial definition which had obeyed the same skein relations that the Jones polynomial and therefore the Witten theory obeyed. So formally, it should be the same theory. Of course, you can't prove the two theories are the same because there's no mathematically precise definition on the Witten side. But then a number of topologists produced a description of the invariant for three manifolds, and this can be eventually descended to the modular functor. So the idea is you start with the surface, and the modular functor V is supposed to tell you something about three manifolds whose boundary is the surface. I didn't say this on a slide, but the modular functor of the surface is a vector space, and if you pick a three-manifold bounding the surface, it determines a vector in that space. So the combinatorial approach to the modular functor is very hands-on. The idea is that you pick a fixed three-manifold which the surface bounds. So if the surface is a genus 2 handle body, which this picture is supposed to represent, then it bounds the solid. If the surface is the genus 2 surface, then sort of a base point three-manifold is just the handle body it bounds. And then you can get to any other three-manifold it bounds by tinkering with the handle body by surgery on a link. You draw some complicated link in there, and you do a process that topologists call surgery, where you cut out the neighborhood of the link and you glue something back in, and all of a sudden you have the general three-manifold. Now, it's possible to describe what appears to be the Witten modular functor and what topologists treat as the Witten modular functor combinatorially by what's called recoupling theory. So you take the surgery description and you pass to certain linear combinations of labeled loops, where the labels come from these particle types or representation labels of the theory. And you can work out, and Kaufman and Linz do this in their book, you can work out the recoupling rules, which correspond to which tell you when two diagrams correspond to the same vector in the modular functor. So there's a roughly what these labels tell you is multiplicities of these strands. So here's what you should think. So I'll tell you what the Hilbert space is first. The Hilbert space is simply as a basis for the modular functor for the two-hole torus. You think of this simple graph as put inside the solid handlebody in such a way that it's a spine for the solid handlebody. The handlebody can be squeezed down to that graph. Okay? And then roughly what you think is any link in there, you just grab it and you squeeze it down to this handlebody, and you look at how many times that link is going over each of the three lines in the handlebody. And those are roughly the labels A, B, and C. Now, the reason I keep saying roughly is A, B, of C are from a finite set, and these are very complicated links. So what happens if it goes over a huge number of times? You need some reduction rule. And that's where these projectors, these Jones-Wenzel projectors, these are very beautiful algebraic objects that tell you in the theory when you exceed the largest allowable label level. So in the first really interesting theory, Chern-Simons theory at level 5, the labels only occupy the states 0, 1, 2, and 3. So if you see four strands going parallel, you can always simplify the picture by this relation, that four strands passing through are equivalent. These four strands passing through are equivalent to the sum of 13 terms with coefficients, where all of which involve some turning around. So this is sort of the main recoupling rule from which others can be derived that makes the theory finite. Sorry, that's him. Oh, okay. Explicit formula for what has never been worked out? Oh, it's very easy to work out. I actually worked them out myself, but I made some mistake, and so I didn't put them in. Yeah, that's right. That's right. There may not be. Well. Yeah, there's a recursive definition, but the calculation would require a quantum computer because it takes exponentially long. Let me still dwell on this slide for a minute. So we have this mysterious object, the modular functor, associated to the surface. And what it's a vector space. And what it's supposed to be telling you, it's supposed to be telling you about three manifolds that bound the surface. Okay, three manifolds whose boundary is the surface. So every such three manifold has a vector there. Now, three manifold bounding the surface, we can encode as a link drawn in the solid handlebody. And then we have some combinatorial rules, which are written out a little more fully here. We have some combinatorial rules for taking this link and turning it into a labeled graph. So this explains why the vector space could turn out to be finite dimensional, because there are these vast array of three manifolds that could bound it, but we're ignoring all kinds of distinctions by these recoupling rules and quotienting down to a finite number of degrees of freedom. Now, this is called functor, and I haven't explained yet the functoriality, and this is a key point. If you twist the surface, if you do a diffeomorphism of the surface, if you cut it along a circle and do a Dane twist and re-glue, that's supposed to affect a unitary transformation of the space V, the vector space. Now, in this picture, you can kind of see how that might happen. Imagine, again, a complicated link in this handle body. If you take a circle like here, take a circle cutting across this arm of the handle body, and you twist it, well, it cut, so slice along that disk and then twist 360 degrees and glue back, then that'll put a full twist in this very complicated link as it goes through that disk. And then when you do the whatever these recoupling rules are to get down to an ABC picture, you'll come up with A prime, B prime, C prime, so you'll have moved the vector. Okay? So that explains how to twist along roughly half the curves on that surface. You'll notice that there are other curves on the surface that go around the holes of the handle body, and there seems to be no way of interpreting directly the effect of that diffeomorphism of the surface. Now, this is where the S matrix of the theory comes in. The surface theory has an S matrix, which can convert a picture that's inside, a link diagram that's inside, to a dual diagram that's outside. And then you can twist there. But this difficulty of not having one picture that works for all twists is what defeats the naive approach to localizing the modular functor, to giving a local description. But it turns out that this obstruction disappears in the case of planar surfaces. Planar surfaces do have functorial local pictures, because in the planar surface case, all it really amounts to is the plane with a bunch of marked points. We can crush the boundary points and think of them as labeled with from our label set. And now, instead of having a graph of this type, ABC, the vectors of the modular functor are labeled by graphs in the ball, or in that lower half space, whose edges are now assigned labels A, B, C, D, whatever, from our label set. So the analogy between this picture and this picture is that in the closed surface case, the graph never comes out to the boundary of the surface. In the planar surface case with boundary, the graph should be thought of as lying slightly below the plane. You see, you can't really tell from the transparency here, but I'm visualizing these points as lying on the plane and the tree is tipped slightly into the lower half space. Now, if you do any diffeomorphism of the planar surface, that is, any element of the braid group, it has a visible action on this tree. Just think of this tree as lying slightly below the horizontal plane, and now if you braid points around, you'll start to tangle up that tree in some complicated way. Now, as that tree gets tangled up by the braiding, you'll see overcrossings appear. But one of the rules in this subject is the Kaufman rule for resolving crossings into embedded pictures, then again collecting strands, and when you find too many strands, more than the levels of your theory, you have that this projector is trivial, and that gives a simplification. And if you like, you can derive 6J symbols, recoupling rules that tell you that whenever you see a certain configuration of labels, you can pass to a linear combination of other labels with the same boundary data. So you can think of so now this gives some combinatorial definition of the moduli space. It's all labelings of these, it's spanned by admissible labelings of these trees, and the action is given geometrically by just extending the braiding into the lower half space, and then to force it back into the same context, you use these various recoupling rules to squeeze the twisted tree back into its straight position, and you compute and see how the new labels fall out. So what's the advantage of having made it so concrete? Well, the advantage for me was I felt that I understood now what the modular functor was, because I had these pictures and I could twist them around and I could couple and recouple, and it sounded like a lot of fun. But from a physics point of view, there's a huge advantage to having these local pictures. And that is, it's possible to describe, give a Hamiltonian description of the modular functor. So in a way, this is a bit of a surprise to people who know Witten's paper and the origins of Chern-Simons theory, because the Witten approach is that e to the 2 pi I k Chern-Simons, it's a Lagrangian approach. And if the Hamiltonian is derived from this directly, you just get identically zero. So it doesn't seem, it seems that Chern-Simons theory should be immune to a Hamiltonian approach. It should, seems inappropriate. But what I'm claiming is that it's possible to slide in a Hamiltonian interpretation from the side. So I didn't put too much detail on this slide. But what it's possible to do is it's possible to take a discrete model. It's possible to take some rectangle of rectangular grid in the lattice and assign a two-level spin system to every edge in the grid, and then a local Hamiltonian H, which is the sum of a lot of terms which act locally and then tensor the identity outside a small neighborhood, such that the ground state of this Hamiltonian when it's built is simply the modular functor V associated with, you know, whatever labels are put on the punctures. And furthermore, there's a physical interpretation to the action of the braid group on the modular functor, which can be described as adiabatic or holonomic evolution of this ground space, ground state, as the Hamiltonian is slowly deformed. Yes. Well, I said take a rectangular grid. So the surface is trivial in this case. It's the plane. Yeah. So there's this problem with the S matrix that I mentioned. If the surface has genus, if it's an interesting surface, I don't know how to give a local description of the modular functor in terms of the ground state of a Hamiltonian, because of this S matrix does not seem to be local. But the S matrix doesn't arise in genus zero. So it's possible to discuss the bit of the modular functor which applies to planar surfaces locally, but that's enough to do quantum computation. The quantum computation, I'll give the reference in a minute, but it's modeled, can be modeled into the braid group, the Jones representation of the braid group. So there's a local description of enough of the theory from my perspective. So I just wanted to explain a little bit about these, about how this Hamiltonian is derived from the pictures. So remember, let's go back to the very first bit of the discussion about homology. This should all be thought of as a generalization of homology. Homology of loops on a surface is you have to first say which pictures are allowed, which pictures represent cycles. So a picture is allowed if it doesn't have any dead endpoints in it. It has to locally look like a manifold. Now you can imagine writing down some Hamiltonian in a lattice model that goes around locally with a microscope and looks at the pictures and verifies. It has an energy penalty if it sees non-manifoldness. So like if you have two edges and a spin is sitting, say you have four edges coming into a vertex in the lattice model, and you have a spin sitting on each edge, well, you can certainly write down a Hamiltonian with four indices whose ground state occurs exactly when the spin is up on zero or two of those four edges. And that condition defines then manifoldness, namely no endpoint, but continuity through that vertex. So it's quite easy to define what an allowable picture is by local conditions, and it's actually not that much more difficult to define all the equivalence relations in the theory through local pictures. The most complicated one was that projector equivalence relation, which had 14 terms, but you can arrange a Hamiltonian which only looks out to radius 4, which sees these pictures and assigns an energy penalty if that relation is violated. So that's a one-dimensional relation, and the orthogonal direction to that relation is an elevated state of that local term. Now, I said looks out to radius 4. That's rather daunting if you want to make this Hamiltonian out of a physical material, since there are 32 bonds under discussion. You'll have a tensor with 32 indices that you have to engineer. Okay, so I think I'm done, well, at least in my mind, with as far as my table of contents with the math and the physics, and I want to now concretely come to the quantum computing. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Right.
Your model of function, if we agree that this B is the state of the space of the generic ground state of,
that's the way I'm going to model it. Yeah. Right. Yeah, it's going to be the zero, the ground state. Yeah, I should have said degenerate, right. I described on the previous slide, I said that G is equal to the ground state of H, and I should have pointed out that this ground state is highly degenerate. The degeneracy is exponential in the number of particles being braided. It's roughly 2 to the n, where n is the number of defects. Yeah, I know that your paper with Wen describes the ground state in those terms, and I don't know of a parallel description. It would be interesting to look at your paper and see. The way I think of the ground state is, let me express it this way. The way topologists are trained to make an invariant object, like homology, is to take the cycles and then divide out by the boundaries. So what you're supposed to do is you're supposed to decide the admissible objects and then decide the equivalence relation. Now, a variant on that, which is actually truer to the analogy, is cohomology, is harmonic forms. There you take the closed forms, okay? These are the things that give well-defined values on cycles by Stokes' theorem. And then the closed forms are still infinite dimensional, so you kind of want to make similar ones equivalent, but you don't really do it that way. You don't impose equivalence relations. Instead, you add a condition, and you say, we're just going to look at the harmonic forms. We're going to look at the co-closed forms we're going to look at the forms that are both closed and co-closed. Okay? So what co-closed can be thought of as sort of an equal weighting condition, and it corresponds to divergence zero for a vector field. That's kind of a uniform weighting of the co-cycle. And what these the Hamiltonians, the local Hamiltonians that I use to enforce the quote equivalence relation, actually are sort of equal weighting conditions. What they say is that the objects in the ground state are some very uniform combinations of pictures, not just random combinations of pictures.
So, just to check one
yeah. Those subscripts like V, A, A, B, C? No. The Hamilton, no, that's not right. The A's determine the final labels on the leaves of the tree. And I would have a different modular functor if I said those labels were one or two. Yes, because the Hamiltonian has to, you see, something different happens at the point that's being braided. There, instead of having a condition that says manifold, you have a condition that says endpoint. Okay? And if the point that was being braided had a higher index, like 3 on it, then you'd have a condition saying trivalent vertex. Now, in the discussion which has come, the relation with quantum computing, all this A's will be 1. There's never any reason. You already have a very interesting and robust representation when every boundary component is labeled with 1, which corresponds to the fundamental representation of SU2, the two-dimensional representation. Sure. So, let's see, I put on this slide, this is my 3-point summary of quantum computation, which I alluded to at the beginning. The usual discussion is in terms of these spatially localized spins. These are the C2s, and you start with some like all spin up, and then you apply local operators, gates, to various pairs of these, and then at the end you measure, say, the first qubit only. That's enough, and the first qubit decomposes the space into a tensor product of 0 tensor rest with 1 tensor rest. And the measurement is simply a 0 or a 1 according to the usual length squared of the projection rule. So a good algorithm is one that comes out very prejudiced this way or very prejudiced this way according to whether the answer to your problem is there a 3 coloring of your graph or whatever you're trying to solve is yes or no. Okay, this is the way a quantum computer is supposed to work. Now the problem is that a quantum computer is composed of units. It can be thought of as a circuit where you have some input at the top and it goes through these gates and some output at the bottom, and the whole thing crashes down if an error is made anywhere. So there's an enormously inventive protocol for producing from a model circuit an unbelievably complicated one that can survive 2 errors. And this looks good because it looks like you've gone from epsilon probability of a mistake to epsilon squared probability of a mistake. But the problem is you've actually gone from epsilon to constant times epsilon squared, where the constant reflects the unbelievably complicated stuff. And when you actually quantify and see how bad that is, you end up with very pessimistic estimates. The original ones were around 10 to the minus 6, though some people are thinking 10 to the minus 5 only. But what this means, or 4, but what this means roughly is that for quantum computing to work, there's a bottleneck that any strategy has to pass through, which is the accuracy bottleneck. You have to think of a way that the chances of a qubit decohering is 1 in a million. The accuracy with which you rotate a phase, if you choose to do so, is to 1 part in a million. I mean, you have these, in order to be able to recover from error, there's this constant but very small tolerance to your computation. And it's a beautiful mathematical achievement due to Shor and then a long list of other people that there is, in fact, a constant. So I don't mean to demean this result at all, but it's a very small constant. And now what I'm hoping is that computing on topological degrees of freedom instead of local spins, say, will provide a passage, sort of a secret passage through this bottleneck, this accuracy bottleneck. So let me just review sort of the math facts around modular functors and quantum computing. So the theory of modular functors and the way the Braid group acts on them is equivalent to quantum computing, and it's a very straightforward equivalence. It doesn't even get into polynomial. It's just basically linear equivalent. And furthermore, you don't need all the modular functors. As I said before, you just need the genus zero case, the braiding points around on the surface. So the representations of the Braid group, the Jones representations of the Braid group, already provide an equivalent model for quantum computation. That was actually partly the substance of what I talked about last fall in the math department here. But now, since then, the new fact is that the Jones representation, you see, on this left-hand screen, there's no addressing the question of where you buy a modular functor. I mean, so modular functors are equivalent to computation, but now you want to order one and build a quantum computer. So now that's the second fact. The second fact is maybe there is some hope of going out and ordering up a modular functor. Maybe I actually believe that they're such natural objects, even though a little mysterious. I believe that they're going to not only exist physically, but they won't be that hard to find. But that's just overexcitement, probably. So the new fact here is that the Jones polynomial can be represented by some medium. And this is what I alluded to before, a two-dimensional lattice of spins coupled by a local Hamiltonian, so that when you slowly braid these singular points in the ground state, the degenerate ground state around each other, when you're done with the braiding, the unitary effect on V is the Jones representation. And then the caveat, of course, is that the present H that I'm discussing is it's local in the mathematical sense because it only involves finite size blocks, but the blocks are really very large. I mean, who can engineer a 32 body interaction to specification? It seems too much. But I put help is on the way because I think that there are some very good ideas for reducing the number of indices. 6 is a very natural number, because the 6 J symbols appear prominently in the discussion. And I think that there's some hope that even just two-body interactions may exist, which don't exactly give these modular functors, but under renormalization, under refinement of the lattice, will rescale and converge maybe exponentially to the topological modular functors. The defects are put in. So the defect is a defect in the state, and it's created by an anisotropy of the Hamiltonian. So there, you know, like you should imagine a little disk in which you have 1,000 declared points that you're going to be doing the braiding, and at those points you have a different rule. Instead of the sum of the number of up spins being 0 or 2 at that point, it's required to be 1. And then when you braid, you have to change that, because braiding means like 10 little steps where you move them along the lattice. Well, I don't have a proposal because I don't know what it's made out of. I mean, I don't know whether you try to grab it with an electric charge and move it, drag it, or, you know, that's for people who know much more than I. No, the defects are simply to have something to braid. I mean, after all, what we're trying to do is represent the braid group, right? And what the braid group is just the fundamental group of the configuration space of n particles in the plane. So you have to have n distinguished points in order to, you know, factor the braid group into the discussion. So these aren't, I'm not thinking of these as like N atoms doped into something. I'm not thinking it that way. It's more that the Hamiltonian's description has N particular points in it, and these can vary in time, and that's how the braiding is accomplished. Okay, I understand what you're coming from. So Dietmar's point is that the Jones representation is actually a little less than this Catalan number, which is itself a little less than 2 to the n. So he's wondering, how is it isomorphic and I said there's an equivalence, but the equivalence is not entirely straightforward. The equivalence takes the modular functor, which, as you say, is not an exact power of 2, and it finds a superspace and a subspace, each of which are powers of 2. And the in order to simulate quantum computing on the modular functor, you show that the Jones representation is dense in the appropriate sectors, so that you can produce up to arbitrary accuracy in any desired automorphism on this particular subspace of dimension 2 to the n. So let's see, the last concrete point I wanted to address, and then I should wrap this up, is the energy gap. So I should say that almost this entire idea of turning the modular functor into a Hamiltonian is actually modeled on a 1997 paper of Alexei Kitaev's, in which he considered the idea, he invented what are called in the business now toric codes. So what he did is he showed how to topologically store quantum information by spin systems with a periodic boundary condition, so spin systems on a torus, as excitations of homology cycles. And he showed in this paper that what the Hamiltonian should be, and it corresponds very closely to homology. And he showed that it had an energy gap. And the reason he was able to assess the energy gap is his local terms all commuted with each other. So it's very easy to discover what the first excited state is. And another feature of his analysis is that you can study the ground state, the splitting of the ground state under perturbation theory. So you can consider, if you perturb the given Hamiltonian by adding local terms, which are sort of noise to the system, you can ask, as you scale the noise, at what rate does the degeneracy separate? Do you get distinct eigenvalues? So how stable is this ground state? And Alexei's analysis is essentially that there's a length scale involved in the problem, and that the stability of the ground state is like e to the minus the length scale. So what this means is that in the braiding context, it means that if you're moving defects on a lattice, that there's a certain lattice spacing that you want to respect. You don't want to, if you keep your defects 10 units apart while you complete the braiding, then you'll accrue a factor of e to the minus constant times 10. That is, the longer you keep, the farther you get an exponential benefit in this stability of the representation in the scale at which you hold the defects apart. And I think it's this exponential factor which is the entire merit of the approach, really. The fact that it's my understanding that it's essentially the same phenomenon in solid-state physics that suppresses tunneling, that if you have a length scale L, that tunneling probabilities will, in many cases, be like e to the minus L. So maybe to conclude, I began the talk with this problem of algebraic localization. I explained that modular functors were mildly mysterious themselves in dimension two and really baffled the experts by the time they tried to localize them to points. And it led to various abstract algebraic discussions, even three categories and so on. But you could say, and I did for 10 years, that I'm not interested in that discussion because that's for algebraists and technical experts and so on. But then I learned of this sort of physical world where you want to localize modular functors not because you're fanatical or algebraic or anything like that, but because you want to build them. If you're going to make them physically, you need a local description, so you have to find the Hamiltonian. So when I realized that this problem was similar to this problem, then I kind of took a serious look. How can you solve this problem? And of course, the experts hadn't missed anything. I mean, it wasn't easy to solve their problem. But it turned out it was easy to solve their problem if you worked on planar surfaces. This is something they'd never tried to do because it didn't interest them. And that's where these pictures, so there's a third point of view, which is these trees, braiding the trees around and recoupling. So braiding trees and recoupling is what I call pictures. And they live in a completely local world. I mean, they're pictures up to equivalence relations. It's just like homology, just like cycles up to Bordism. So this is a completely local world. So you have what I call combinatorial localization, and that leads in a routine way to physical localization. You can write down the Hamiltonian as I described. And I think morally it should lead to a solution of this algebraic problem if I could only understand what that problem is. But it's quite abstract. So that's sort of the talk summary. And then my last transparency is my dream for the future. So thank you very much.
You started off with this discussion of current climate theory.
Yeah. It did. Well, the thing is, we wouldn't. So the question is, where did this representation of the braid group come from? I mean, it came historically from subfactors, right? So that's sort of my first slide. I mean, that's Okay, here it is. So it came from all these places, and you're right, it did drop out of the picture in a logical sense. That is, all these antecedents to the modular functor, the only ones that are strictly necessary to find this H that I was talking about are the Jones, his start on it, the subfactors, and the translation of that into combinatorics, which is what I followed. So it's just this path and this path that are necessary to find the H. Now, this path, you know, I have a fondness for. I mean, that's sort of the way I entered the subject. I found this and this too complicated. Probably too complicated because they're mathematically rigorous. I found Witten's path, the modular functor, something I could readily understand, even though I couldn't, you know, prove it was well defined. So that's the reason I kind of based the beginning part of the talk on the Chern-Simons theory. To be fair historically, I'm not sure that the combinatorial reductions that Reshetykin and Turiev did could have been done without this paper. I don't know. What do you think, Dietmar? It seems to me, if Witten hadn't written this paper and done this work, it's not quite clear it's not quite clear that that would have followed.
In most fiscal systems, if there's a large degeneracy, say, that the system's very sensitive to perturbation, and somehow here you have a situation where you have a large degeneracy of zero energy state, and you want to argue that that could be somehow less sensitive.
Right. Well, let me agree with you that the larger the space, the space grows with genus in this picture, okay? And as the surface gets more genus on it, if it's, say, keeping its area constant, then its handles are getting thinner, so the length scale of essential loops is getting smaller, and that's going to make the ground state less stable. So I agree with you, as the dimension grows, it'll become less stable. You'll have to refine your lattice to keep the length scales above the acceptable splitting. So I'm not saying that as the state is more degenerate, that's a plus or that helps it remain stable. What I'm saying is that in order to create a model with a certain amount of stability, what you have to do is you have to take a degree of lattice refinement so that the shortest essential loop on the surface or the shortest distance between two defects is constant.
Don't you have to avoid decoherence if you either drag one particle around the other?
Yeah.
But I'm happy to keep them far apart, much farther apart from the lattice or anything. So the splitting is very small. But you have to, when you drag that particle around, it's going to be melting into things, going on and what have you.
Yeah. So the argument regarding that is actually I think it's sort of on one of these slides, is to consider the tunneling between orthogonal ground states. So in other words, suppose your ground state initially is in this direction, and you braid it around, and it's supposed to end up here. And you want to estimate the tunneling amplitude for getting for ending up over here. And now, since this vector here that you don't want to end up in is in the same degenerate ground state, it looks like there's zero energy barrier between them. But that's only true if you consider global perturbations. If you consider operators, which are the source of your error, your phonon or whatever, if you consider operators that are only allowed to act locally, then there's a energy hill of order this length scale that I keep talking about that has to be crossed at some point in time between these two orthogonal ground states. So it's going over this energy mountain. So local operators see an energy mountain between two orthogonal ground states in the degenerate ground state, and that's what's intended to confer stability. So this is the analysis in Kataev's paper in the simpler case of homology, and I believe a similar analysis is probably true, but probably mathematically a little out of reach for the model I'm proposing. You need an energy gap. Right. You need a gap. Right. 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 So in the system on which this discussion is modeled, the homology codes, the individual pieces of the Hamiltonian that are summed together all commute with each other. So it's very easy to see what the first excited state is. The first excited state is just the first excited state of one individual Hamiltonian and ground state for all the others. So in such a system, you do see an energy gap. Now, in the construction of the Hamiltonian, which mimics these recoupling rules, it's much more ad hoc, and it doesn't seem possible to write down local Hamiltonians which commute with each other. So I don't have, in this context, the same argument for finding an energy gap, but I suspect there is an energy gap based on the relation between diffusion and the eigenvalues of the Laplacian in between classical states. There's a principle that, well, actually, this is seen in graph theory, right? If you have a graph that's very connected as opposed to long and spread out, then its first eigenvalue will be high instead of, you know, it'll resonate with a high note instead of a low note. There's some kind of intuitive argument that this will have a gap, but I agree that the gap is critical to the stability.